Welcome to the Social Podcast, where no discussion or debate is off limits.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this edition of the Social Podcast. I'm Cynthia Loist, alongside Melissa Grello, Lainey Louie, and Jess Allen. And we're starting with a story that's on everyone's minds. Mel?
We are starting on a very, very heavy note today as we are processing the devastating mass shooting at a Texas elementary school. 19 children and two adults were killed after a teenage gunman opened fire in their classroom. It is now the deadliest shooting in the U.S. since Sandy Hook, which was 10 years ago. I guess everybody asking the same questions, ladies. Mm-hmm. What is it going to take for America to finally change?
I mean, I don't think there's an easy answer to that question. I think if there was, we would have seen something happen at Sandy Hook. And actually, since Sandy Hook, there have been over 900 shootings on school grounds in America. And I mean, it's interesting. Yeah, we're seeing a lot of outrage. Joe Biden, in fact, went and he said, what struck me on that 17-hour flight when he got the news of this was that these kinds of mass shootings rarely happen anywhere else in the world. Why are we willing to listen to this carnage, to live with this carnage? He asked that. And after this speech, a Republican Florida state representative basically threatened Biden. He said, take our guns, Biden, and you'll learn why the Second Amendment was written in the first place. When you just sit there with that kind of a mentality, I don't think you can change that. I don't think there's one thing that can change that because there's something. And I actually don't even think the gun control laws would help at this point, because what you've got is this attitude towards guns that is baked into the identity of America, coupled with a massive amount of mental illness, probably in part to do with the pandemic, to do with lack of resources, to do with the shrinking middle class. I could go on and on. And so within this, you know, easy access to guns and no supports for people who need it the most, you're going to have mass shootings again and again.
But is that a myth? Like, you know, I think that there are people who are vocal like that about their guns, but we hear all the time that in America, many people, including those who use guns, are in favor of stricter gun laws and safe laws. It's the legislators. It's the people who are elected who are, some say, controlled by the gun lobby. Because, again, just like we say on many issues, including abortion, the majority of Americans want safer laws. It's just, do they go from there to voting for the people who would put those laws in place?
I think that's exactly. I'm sure we all watched NBA coach Steve Kerr give that impassioned, frustrated, you know, angry speech about this very thing, that 90% of Americans do want more stringent gun laws, at least the background checks, at the very least that. And he sort of spelled it out that House Resolution 8, I believe, it was passed in the House 2 years ago. And 50 senators are just sitting on this and kind of refuse to vote for it. And he's basically saying they have blood on their hands. They're not doing anything. And
in
that
speech, it's a small group of people.
It's a small group of people who have so much power. And as he said, they're refusing to relinquish that power. And then he went on about he was so frustrated, but there was a basketball game to play. He had no choice. And that ticked for me for some reason. I know he didn't have a choice, but then there was part of me like, do you have a choice? Like, don't play the game. Teachers refuse to go to school. I know that's so improbable, but it's also improbable that this is the only place in the world where teachers and students, as young as like grade one, grade two, grade three, have routine active shooter drills. Mm-hmm. There was this whole thing on Twitter with people who are now in their 30s sharing the trauma of having these drills where they weren't told it was a drill.
Wow.
And just groups of kids crying and basically just teachers being instructed like, you're going to have to sacrifice yourself. And students being told they should form two groups so that one group is probably going to be killed, but the second group will be saved. Like nowhere else in the world are kids exposed to the threat of being hunted in a classroom.
And I think Biden mentioned that, is that he's saying children watching each other die like as if they're on a battlefield.
Yes!
And these were a bunch of fourth graders in Texas, which we're now learning, the vast majority of which were young Latino kids in a very small tight-knit rural community. Everybody knows everybody in this community. Interestingly, Matthew McConaughey's hometown, because I think he could have a big influence here. But I do think of two things. Things can be done because other countries in the world have shown that. In 1996, Australia banned semi-automatic and assault-style rifles in response to a mass shooting that happened there. And a man killed 35 people and wounded 18 others. And what was the difference? The legislators were able to be on the same page. And within 8 weeks, they had had the assault rifle ban. And you want to know what the result was? Two major things happened. All gun violence dropped. They didn't have another mass shooting for 22 years.
Yeah.
Not one. Suicide by guns, that dropped 80%.
Wow.
In other words, it's possible. And is it that different? Australia, they got their hunting.
Mm-hmm.
They love their guns too. And shockingly, life has gone on as normal in Australia with handguns, still legal by and large, but assault rifles being the thing that was taken off the table. And how did they do that? A very generous buyback. They included a new tax. It was actually a medical tax. And they used that to buy back an enormous amount of guns, mm-hmm. assault rifles that were on the street. In other words, it can be done if there is a political will to do so. And secondly, as Canadians, and we sit here going, oh my gosh, you know, I said it many times and I'll continue to say it. America sneezes and Canada catches a cold.
Agreed.
Where we have mass shootings in Canada, which luckily is not even close to the frequency of the United States, there are young white men being radicalized on American websites with far-right rhetoric. So what is happening in the States when there is a spillover effect, it does affect us.
We've also had,
so we have
right
to
in our own communities, we have had several stabbings at high schools in recent weeks. And so it's not like we can't address the fact that there is violence on the increase in many types of communities. But when we bring it back to this particular story, like I opened up my phone and I saw this photo of this child. And I mean, obviously, you shouldn't have to see a photo. This is Uzziah.
Oh my God.
I want to get his name right. Garcia. And he's my son's age. And I mean, this child got up and got dropped off the same way I drop off my son every day to school. There were teachers who were in there who went to school to teach children. You know, no one should have to go into a classroom ever expecting violence to occur. And I can't stop thinking, I mean, I don't know if you're doing this, but like, I know Jai will hear about this on the schoolyard.
Marquesa told me about this story. So I'll tell you something. Last night, this was all over the news, and I said, I'm not turning the news on. And I said, Marquesa, she was doing her homework. I said, Mommy's going to go watch TV over there, and I don't want you to come. You focus on your homework. And you know what she said to me? I already know what you're going to watch. It's the school shooting.
Oh, my God.
I don't know how she heard about it. I don't actually know how she heard about it. Maybe in the radio, on the car ride home. Like, I actually don't know. And they're on it. And you know what Marquesa said last night? Mommy, can I sleep in your bed? And guess what? Of course. She didn't have to say why. And I, as a mother, was like, how many parents don't get to do this tonight in Texas? Like, and the kids are on it. And so I don't know how you shield them from this. I don't actually know. How do you explain this?
Well, they didn't. I mean, they have tried since Sandy Hook and before. They haven't done anything. Like, I think it's built in. You know, Melissa, you cited the example of Australia. I just, you know, it can be done. Everybody needs the political will. But can you change the DNA of a country?
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, Amanda Gorman tweeted this about America. And, I mean, is there anything more true than this? The truth is one nation under guns. So it's built into it's on this piece of paper that they revere, right?
Yeah.
This Second Amendment, and they point to as what America is the right to own firearms above and over the life of a child. I mean, that's the message. Mm-hmm. They haven't learned. I don't know. I don't
and
want to be
all,
defeatist.
They're all trying, like, you know, to discard Roe v. Wade. They care so much about children.
Well, that's
they
another thing.
So much.
They care about the unborn children, but the born children. Yeah, let's.
There's no protection.
Yeah.
You know, I was going to say, I hope we don't have to talk about this again, but the sad truth is we probably will. On that note, we are going to take a very quick break. We've got more show coming up right after this.
You're listening to The Social Podcast. We're just getting started. Stick around. You're listening to The Social Podcast on the iHeartRadio Canada Network. Download the show wherever you find your favorite podcasts. And make sure to catch The Social weekdays at 1 p.m. on CTV.
Welcome back to The Social Podcast with Melissa Grello, Jess Allen, Lainey Louie, and me, Cynthia Loist. Here's a question.
is it okay to date someone who is 25 years younger? That's what we're asking. A woman in her late 60s wrote to Miss Manners wanting to know if that's inappropriate. What do you think? Would you date someone 25 years younger than you?
Have you ever heard of that love math formula?
No.
So that thing where it says you divide your age in half plus seven, and that is your threshold for how much younger you can date. You never heard of this?
No.
I think it's out there in the
culture. Based on what, science?
Science, please. But there's, it's, I don't know, Tyrone and I were talking about it at E-Talk yesterday, and he had heard of it. So yeah, it's your age divided by two plus seven. So
29.
So for, yeah, there you go. So it'd be cool for you to date a 29-year-old and no
nothing younger.
Yeah.
Okay, I can see that. I could see that.
I mean, I don't know if you buy into it that, but what is the threshold like? Because if there's no formula, like how do you just do you arbitrage? I would never date anyone X years younger than me.
Because everyone's maturity is so different. No two guys that are 29 are going to be the same necessarily.
Okay,
no.
So
are
a 21-year-old who's super mature is good.
That's too much of a spread. That's too much of a spread. You haven't had enough life experience. For me, I think my threshold would be 25.
25
yeah.
loves
even at the now, youngest.
25 you at the age you are now.
Yes.
What about when you're 60?
I don't know. That will probably change. I would say
20.
Yeah, I would say 20.
Probably lower.
Hey, listen, men have been doing it for years.
Miss Manners said she sent along her best wishes and suggested ignoring anyone who does not agree with this lady. This lady that sounded like she was a time traveler from a different era. The gentleman asked whether I would be his lady and accept his ring. That's how she speaks.
Even calling him a gentleman.
She's a magical lady. She deserves this happiness. She's not of our time.
But this is gendered, right? We're all as four ladies sitting here talking about how young would we go. Do you think men sit around and say, just how young would you go?
No, it's a great question.
No, it's just how old would you go?
Well, yeah exactly. Exactly. And I just think, though, I am on team, like, let's normalize seeing older women with younger men. So thank you, Harry Styles. Thank you, Nick Jonas. Thank you, Corey Gamble.
Thank you, Jess.
Like, this is, I love normalizing this. And they're only, like, a decade apart. These two are actually 25 years apart.
Are they really?
This is 10 years apart. But let's normalize that. Like I said, men have been doing it since the beginning of time.
I don't think I could do it. I mean, you just mentioned you and Simon. You had 10-year spread. That's fine.
9.5 or 8.5.
Okay, but hold on. How old was he and you when you started dating?
That's the kind of creepy part.
He was 20 and I was 29.
Oh.
Well, I don't think that's creepy.
I don't think
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much
I
for
also think he's like an, I mean, it's that
he
kind
is.
Of classic.
He's like an old man.
He really is like an old man. I mean that in the most like.
He speaks like this lady. Milady. Would you like to go for a stroll in the park?
I couldn't do it though. Like I couldn't, I don't think I could do it. Even though we talk about, like, obviously when I think about like Timothy Chalamet or like Harry Styles, like I obviously can find reasons like in my imagination that I would be into this. But when I put it into practical, like hanging out together, I don't know. The part of me is like, I don't know how to describe this. I find my sexiness comes from a reciprocation of like that they find me hot and I find them hot. And there's something inside of me, and what I'm about to say might sound ageist, is making the assumption that somebody of a certain age would definitely not find me attractive. That there would definitely be like.
Are you being ageist against yourself?
I am being ageist against myself. Aww. That when I'm with Jason, I can recognize like, you know, it's like, oh, there's things about, like we're the same age-ish. So I can be like, we find each other attractive, but we got the same kinds caliber of flaws. With somebody waiting, you guys are looking at me like I'm speaking another language. I just dawned on you.
You are like a vixen.
No, there are things happening that are
You're
not
so
of the same age.
Right.
And I'm fine with them. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to be down on myself.
Yeah.
It's just that I feel like you get into that Ashton Kutcher, Demi Moore thing.
I hear what you're saying.
Where you're chasing a kind of
I hear
like,
what you're saying, but let me give you an example. Like Vera Wang. Right? A photo of Vera Wang.
Right.
She's 73 years old.
Yes.
So if you look at Vera Wang and you look at her as a 73-year-old woman, you're like, okay, she needs to be with someone around her age. No, sorry. No 73-year-old dude is looking like the same way that Vera's looking.
Fair.
So that's why she has to date younger.
Yeah.
Because
that's her equal.
That's right.
Physically.
Right. When she was 63, she dated a 27-year-old,
Evan
Lysacek.
Because, well, think about who Vera Wang is. Yeah. Anyway, go look on her Instagram if you don't know what 7
well, I am okay. immediately going to do this. But speaking of younger men, a husband wrote to Slate for advice saying his wife is adamant their son becomes a good man and cleans up after himself in the bathroom. Here's the catch. This little young man is only 5 years old. So is that too much pressure to put on a kid?
Okay, I want to fill in a few details on this story because generally you're like, well, what's wrong with that if he's 5? I mean, kids as young as 2 in daycare, they make a mess and then they have that cute little cleanup song. Clean up, clean up, right? Like, we're teaching kids young that you can clean up after yourself. So that doesn't sound groundbreaking, except for the fact that it's the husband who wrote in for this story. And he actually used the words, this is bordering on abusive. Because if the son doesn't do it right the first time, he must go back and do it until it's right.
Yeah, we're talking about peeing on the seat here.
Peeing on the seat.
Peeing on the seat.
Specifically.
Yeah.
And that there's now a little bucket of rags so that if the son keeps messing up the cleanup, he's got to go back. And that's what the husband takes issue with.
Yeah.
So now I have a couple of questions. What's the relationship like between mom and dad? Because they're not talking. Mm-hmm. Mom's taken the lead. Mom has said she was raised with a mom and she will not under any circumstances raise a man that has a woman have to clean up after him. So there's questions I have about the dynamic between mom and dad. And finally, the tone. Is mom making it playful? Or is she like, you better clean up that pee drop or else?
I don't think she's going full mommy dearest, but she is saying to him, like, hey, this wasn't good enough. I need you to go back and do it again. To the 5-year-old, just saying that out loud sounds a little, maybe a little intense, but there's part of me that really likes this. I think peeing on toilet seats and leaving it is highly disrespectful. And you guys are always saying pets are like your kids and stuff like that. We train puppies to not pee on a carpet and stuff like that. So why would you treat your 5-year-old any different? Plus, he gets a cute little catty cleaning thing to do it.
I don't know. I think it's one thing. I remember Jaya being that age, and if he spilled, like, milk, I would say to him, I wouldn't make him. It wouldn't be like,
clean it up.
But it would be like, here you go. You can do this up. And it became something cute. But I think this idea of having a little kit, there's something a bit maniacal about the whole thing. I also think it's a lot of work. Like, this mother, I mean, we say a lot of times that the mom seems to wear the weight of raising bad sons or men who, like, sons who don't become good men. And I think, like, that's a lot of pressure. Like, why does it have to fall to her?
Where is dad?
Where is dad?
Especially
in this?
When we're talking about peeing.
Yeah.
Because they pee, presumably, the child and the father pee the same way with the same apparatus. Yes?
Yeah.
So standing up, in this case, it sounds.
We're talking about training them, then wouldn't it be the father, if the son is, you know, spraying it all over the place, then I feel like it would be the responsibility of the father to be like, hey, son, here's how you not spray.
Yeah. Sit.
So
the answer is sit.
Oh, just looking at our group.
Well, just sit down.
Yeah.
Okay.
There it is. All right. Good luck, mom. I don't know if we're going to solve this, but let's move on to our next topic. Check this out. Adidas and Gucci are selling a $2,000 umbrella that is not waterproof. According to the website, it's meant for sun protection and decorative use, and it's being heavily mocked on social media in China. Is it fair to be outraged here?
Well, if you're buying a $1,500 umbrella, maybe you have bigger problems, or maybe you have no problems at all if you can buy a $1,500 umbrella. And let's be honest, they're buying it because of the logo stuff. There was another partnership between Adidas and Balenciaga, and someone posted the images side by side of, like, the Adidas track shirt, the Adidas track pants beside the Balenciaga. And it just says Balenciaga, little tiny. So it went from being a $40 jacket to a $1,500 jacket. So you're just paying for that. If that's your jam, then you're getting what you deserve, I guess, maybe.
We all know that rich people never get caught in the rain.
Yeah.
I call bluff on all of this. If you can afford a $1,500 umbrella, which, by the way, I looked online just because I thought, is it still for sale? And it is. It very clearly says it's a sun umbrella.
They updated it, apparently, after the outrage.
Great, but for my mother always, it's, I guess, a parasol.
A 1,500-year-old parasol.
That
sounds very reasonable.
That's very normal in Filipino culture. Everybody's got umbrellas because they want to be protected from the sun. That is very, very common. So
the thing is, I don't think they did it very intelligently if they were marketing to the Asian
market like China, they were the ones who backlashed. Because yes, I mean, this traditionally is a Chinese thing. It goes back centuries. Parasols, they were made out of paper or silk.
Yeah.
So you market it that way, then maybe culturally people aren't upset with you. But they were trying to sell it to both people. An umbrella for rain, I guess, but also you can say it's a sun umbrella, but it's not really. You know those parasols, like the ancient
Japanese. Yeah, totally.
They're
beautiful,
yeah.
Love them. I love
them. Yeah, make one of those. Yeah. Then sell it for that much money using the craftsmanship. I think they would have had a better experience.
Can anyone just explain to me why, outside of this, like umbrellas are so crappy just in general? Like, you got one job, umbrella makers, to make a good umbrella. And why is it that I buy the $7 one, I would say
maybe
once a year?
Maybe because we buy the $7 one.
Yeah. Oh, you think if I spent
$1,500? No. I think if we spent $50 in an umbrella, no, yes, have it
there
for
is a
difference.
$30 to $50 in, range
really?
Umbrellas
there is a
are
difference.
Really good. Yes.
Yes. Yes. There is a difference.
And less, or more environmental, too, because how many times you throw out the $7 umbrella?
I want to hear from people.
Don't,
on this one.
Yeah,
if don't
cheap out on your umbrella.
Yeah. On a $40 invest. It's a small one. I want to know. I don't want one of those long, big ones. I want
well,
a small
you can use
one.
The compact.
No.
I want a small
those,
one.
The compact ones, but not $7. Go for the $30 to $50 range
right.
And it'll last
yeah,
you
it's
a few
true.
Years.
You get what you pay for unless it's $1,500.
Okay.
Then in that case, forget it.
Still to come on The Social Podcast, how do you know when it's the right time to leave a job? Plus, the absolutely fabulous Dame Joanna Lumley shares inside stories about Queen Elizabeth. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Next week on The Social, Scott Speedman stops by to tell us all about Crimes of the Future, his new film with director David Cronenberg. The Social, weekdays at 1 p.m. on CTV.
Welcome back to The Social Podcast on the iHeartRadio Canada Network. I'm Cynthia Lois, and back for another round, you've got Melissa Gorello, Lainey Louie, and Jess Allen. Jess.
So it's the end of an era at SNL. Last weekend, Kate McKinnon, Pete Davidson, Aidy Bryan, and Kyle Mooney all signed off for the last time. So is this the right time for them to leave? And more personally, how do you know when it's the right time to leave a job?
I mean, first, I just want to say it was something we were talking about this morning, which was that the headlines all over Twitter were all about Pete Davidson leaving. And it really did start to eclipse like Aidy Bryant and in particular Kate McKinnon, who, I mean, they just did. They are like such huge talents. And this is not to say that Pete isn't a talent, but I mean, it really bothered me over the weekend.
The one name everyone was concentrating on.
It just
on.
Felt like a really, you know, really sad to me. But anyway, I remember having this experience when I was, I used to belly dance for 10 years. People know this. It was sort of my side hustle as I was just starting out as a producer in television. And I loved it. I never really thought about it not being in my life. And it was something that I did every single weekend. I made money out of doing it. But then there was this one day where I showed up to a show and I kind of got into an argument with the musicians, and then I kind of got into the owner of the club was kind of bugging me, and I remember getting off stage, getting in my car and being like, that's the last time I'm ever going to do that.
No way. And you just
that
knew
quickly? I just knew that,
that
quickly.
One night.
It was like, I guess like slowly, if I look back and think, like, there were a few times where it started to feel less pleasurable. It was more of a job. It started to shift. I found myself not looking forward to it, but I didn't expect that day when I did that would be it. Sometimes you just know. It's kind of like a relationship ending. Wow. You just are like, you wake up and you're like, and I'm done. And that was it. I mean, it's a bit weird to me, but that's what happened.
But isn't it, you that was your side hustle. And I'm sure all of these SNL stars have stuff in the pipeline that they're doing. Like the idea, when you hear about people who do that, leave a job without anything else lined up, oh my God, it gives me so much anxiety. It's so brave. I think the risk, you know, the reward is always greater, sometimes with a greater risk taken. But man, I'm like a baby bird in that nest.
Yeah.
Just waiting for the mama bird to push me out. And she's like, I don't want to go. I don't want to go. And then the feeding.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, listen, it's an interesting thing because there's a lot of people out there in jobs that they haven't yet found their dream job and they don't have the luxury to be picking and choosing. Like today, I'm moving on, but it's like this is all that they're able to do at the moment. I think it's the pleasure thing. And I think for me, it's challenging. It's being challenged and growing. And I think that everybody wants to be in a job that, I mean, some people, they like comfort zone. I'm not one of those comfort zone people. I find that when I look back in my career, when I left teaching as an example,
I felt like once I really got a handle of it, which takes sometimes years for teachers because it's so hard. You feel like you're reinventing the wheel. And by the time I reinvented my wheel, I was like, okay, I think I'm done now. Yeah. And I was shocked by that because I thought I'd hit it. It'd be easier street. It's not easy street. Easier.
How long did you do it?
I was teaching for 2 years.
Wow.
And then decided to leave to go do my master's. Mm-hmm. And then I quit that. I just hit walls, but I realized because I wasn't being fulfilled for something bigger. And then, you know, it led me here. And I've never woken up one day where I didn't want to run to work. Well, maybe that one time I was drinking too much, but no, I'm just kidding. No. I totally tease. But I think for the most part, I wake up every day excited. And I think the day that you wake up and you're not excited, you know, I think you should listen. Mm-hmm. And if you've got the ability to make moves, and again, not everybody can.
Yeah.
I think you look for other things.
I think that's the key is not everybody can. And I think even the ability to make that call, whether or not you have anything lined up, is in and of itself a luxury, and particularly a luxury for women. You know, you made that call for belly dancing, I think, in your 20s, right?
Yeah.
Same with you in teaching. Mm-hmm. It's a different story in your 40s and 50s for women.
Yeah.
In every industry, not just entertainment, you hit a point as a woman where you might not be ready to leave, but they leave you.
Mm.
They ask you out the door. You're too old for this. We have heard many stories in every industry about women who are aged out just because of some arbitrary thing and where men are aged out at the same age. So I feel like, and I'll take the lead on this, I'm the oldest here. I'm coming up on an age where, you know, I'm hitting 50 soon. And I wonder how long it's going to be before someone taps on my door and says, you're too old. We've got someone else lined up for you. Mm-hmm. Or even in an industry where I'm also a gossip columnist and I report on younger people because, you know, this churn of celebrity doesn't stop.
Oh, that's them calling. That's them calling.
Is that calling me?
Is
my
time done
for you? Am I being,
yeah?
Just, it's for you.
Am I aging out?
Okay. Just let me finish this segment. Thanks. Sorry, I'm gone. I'm too old.
I feel like that's a first.
That was
How
creepy.
Has it been almost 10 years and we've never had a phone call live on the show?
This is true.
It's amazing.
This is true.
I hear everything you're saying.
Yeah, like, I mean, I get emails all the time from people who are like, you're reporting on whatever, you're too old. And
what?
You know, and I think that is the two sides of our mouth thing that we talk about, right? On the one hand, we're like, yeah, women should be able to do anything any age. Then other women are like, well, not if you're a gossip columnist and not if you're this, not if you're that. So I think that, like, for sure, I'd love to leave anything on my own terms. But as women, we always right now have to leave open room for the possibility that someone will leave you before or exit you before you are ready to exit world.
Great point.
All right. On that low note, why don't we talk about something else? Unless the phone's going to ring. We need to settle a domestic dust up. So a woman wrote to The Guardian saying her husband thinks it's okay to dust with a dry cloth. But she insists the only way to clean is with a wet cloth.
Her friendships right are going to be decided here.
Yeah. Let's go. Wet or dry?
I'll just start by saying I don't dust.
What?
I don't dust. Simon dusts.
Okay.
Because I think, and I don't know how he dusts because I don't pay attention to it.
Right.
He doesn't let me dust because he says I'm very surface, like my personality probably. Like I don't put in a lot of effort. Like I just like, oh, this looks clean. But I don't do a deep clean. So that's why I'm not really allowed to do
it. So you've never seen him do it and know what he uses.
Well, I've seen him, but like I haven't zoned in. So what is the right answer? So, but now
First of all, can we just unpack who invented that feather duster? Like, to me, that is just an allergen mixed with like moving around dust and allergies. I don't get it. To me, you need wet. Like you need something to collect the dust. I'm kind of surface too, I think, but
oh
you need something to collect the dust and then kind of dry it off.
Okay, so I'm on team dry.
What?
But there's a caveat. They make very fancy fabrics now, where they are literally like a microfiber cloth. Those are actually made with a positive charge because dust is a negative charge. So they're actually meant to be used dry.
Okay, here's my question.
They collect, so they hold.
So you collect it. So you...
Yeah.
You gotta rinse it off, right? What do? You just go like this?
I shake mine outside. So here's the problem with wet, I find, if it's not like a special cloth. If it's wet, it looks good in the moment.
Oh.
But there is actual stuff in there. So the second it dries, you look closely. You've actually just put wet dust on there and then it dries. You actually have to remove the dust.
This is very scientific business, guys. I don't know.
Lainey, tell us about your dusting rituals.
I don't clean. We all know this.
But I find the dry, if I had to clean, dry dusting to me sounds like a horror movie. I'd like, this is gross, moving it around. And I know what you're saying about your microfiber thing, but I like, it's not only wet for me, I think you have to spray it. Lysol the dust.
Oh my God.
Wet and Lysol.
Someone
kill the dust.
Nodding. Yep.
Eliminate every germ. That's how I live.
Yeah.
Is that
I
okay?
Guess it's mostly like our body stuff. Too,
well, it's
right?
probably our skin cells,
our
hair
skin cells.
It's insane. Animal dander.
Yeah. Correct.
But I think I hear remotes clicking across the country.
Disinfectant.
So I'm going to throw it a break.
Maybe someone should call you.
Is it calling for me? Anyway.
Time for another break, friends.
Still to come on The Social Podcast, beloved UK actor and AbFab star Joanna Lumley's new book celebrating Queen Elizabeth. You're listening to The Social Podcast. Find us on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your favorite shows. And join the conversation online at The Social CTV.
Welcome back to The Social Podcast. You've got Melissa Grello and me, Jess Allen. Our next guest is considered showbiz royalty in the UK, hailing from one of the most iconic British shows ever made. Absolutely Fabulous, a.k.a. AbFab.
And speaking of royalty, she has been a massive fan of the Queen her whole life, and she's bringing that love to the pages of her brand new book, A Queen for All Seasons, a celebration of Queen Elizabeth II on her Platinum Jubilee. We are absolutely thrilled to have us with her today, BAFTA award-winning actress and dame Joanna Lumley, live from London. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be with you in Canada.
So listen, this is a beautiful, beautiful tribute to the Queen. And you spoke to so many people who've interacted with her over many, many years. So can you share an anecdote from your book that really sums up the woman behind closed doors that we just don't often get to see?
Well, we don't, because we know her from banknotes and photographs and coins and stamps and things. And we simply never know her because she never gives interviews. But what I was thrilled to have was all these first-hand accounts from people. There was a particular man who wrote a book called War Doctor. He was talking about his time in Aleppo in Syria. And he was terribly battle-scarred by it. He'd seen some absolutely appalling things. He was invited to lunch at Buckingham Palace and sat on the Queen's left hand. And she turned to him and said, "Where have you come from?" And he said, "I expect she imagined I'd say something like Hammersmith, which is a borough in London. Instead, I said Aleppo." And she said, "What was it like there?" And he said, at that moment, he just suddenly felt that he was on the brink of tears and was just going to come and burst into tears and just not be able to speak. He found he couldn't speak. The Queen noticed this, and she reached forward, and on the table, she had a little box, which she opened it up, and it had dog biscuits inside. And she said, "Take some of these." And the dogs, the corgis, of course, the famous corgis, are always around under the table when they're eating. And she said, "Let's feed the dogs." And so she fed the dogs with him. And then she talked to him about the dogs and all their names and which ones were the parents of which other ones and how many she'd had. And then at the end, she patted him on the hand and she said, "There, that's better than talking, isn't it?" And I think that was so sensitive. And it's a sort of side of her that we don't really see, because we see her being royal. We see her in processions or cutting a tape or a ribbon or opening Parliament. But we never see this kindly woman, this mother and grandmother and great-grandmother, being so gentle with somebody who she'd only just met.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. It's a beautiful story. And Joanna, you, of course, have had a lot of royal interactions over the years. You've been awarded many accolades for your services to drama, entertainment, and your incredible charity work. And you were recently made a dame. Congratulations on that. Here's the question, though. What's it like? You've met the Queen on multiple times. So does it ever get old? Are you always a little nervous? And what does it feel like?
Honestly, you're always absolutely speechless, because she's like the most famous movie star you've ever seen. And as she comes closer, there's something so familiar about her. And yet so, I don't know, you just get struck dumb. You begin to talk nonsense. I've just got to say that. So I think the Queen must go around thinking that the world is filled with complete idiots, because you mean to say the right things. But there are so many rules of the Queen. You mustn't start the conversation. You mustn't butt in. You mustn't stop the conversation. You've got to say Your Majesty the first time you address her. And then after that, it's ma'am, and it's ma'am to rhyme with ham and not mom to rhyme with harm or anything like that. So you're already dazzled by what you must and mustn't do. And then this kind face with these very blue eyes looks up at you. And she's got a very deep and special way of looking at you. I always find I'm absolutely overwhelmed. And you've got to remember to curtsy. You may not curtsy in Canada, but we do here in this country. And I thought, oh, I can sink right down to the ground and do a full court curtsy like that. And said, oh, that's terrible. Just do a nice little bob. So the whole thing is very thrilling. And I've got to say, when she goes away from you, people say, what did she say? Do you know, you can't even remember. You've been in such a cloud of sort of strange magic, a time lapse. You never really get used to it. I didn't, anyway.
Does that mean if for something like a giant curtsy, are you planning out what you're wearing ahead of time? Are you putting a lot of thought into
it? Honestly, my mind is on nothing else. And I kind of think, oh, maybe I'll look quite smart. Of course, it won't be the Queen who actually gives me my damehood. I think it might be Prince Charles or maybe Prince William, maybe Princess Anne, because the Queen isn't doing it anymore because she's quite frail and quite old. And but also you want to look your best. And I think that they pin something onto you like this. You've got a little bar and they hook something onto it. And you think, well, I want to wear a hat because you're expected to. But what kind of hat? Do I want to wear something the size of, you know, a tureen? Or do I wear a little modest kind of beret and look a bit glum like a schoolgirl? Oh, I'm thinking of it all the time, I tell you.
Can we go back in time just a little bit, Dame? Because But can you take us back to the moment that you get this letter? We understand it was like, you know, snail mail, as we may call it here. I love the idea that you got something in the mail close to Christmas announcing that, you know, you were going to be named a dame. Like, what is that moment like? Do you think for a second, is this real?
Oh, my God. The envelope itself is so formal and it looked like it had come from the Home Office or something. And I thought, what have I done wrong? You know, did I park in the wrong place or something gone wrong, not paid my taxes? But anyway, I opened it up and it said, Madam, you know, you're going to become a DBE, which means Dame of the Order of the British Empire. Do you know, I was so shocked. I burst into tears. I was just so amazed. I was so stunned because it was completely, completely unexpected. I'd been lucky enough to have been made an OBE many years ago, in 1995 or something. And that letter came months before January. And this was in the middle of December. And I thought, oh, maybe they've made a mistake. Maybe somebody's dropped out. Anyway, I was thrilled. And I had to write back and say, yes, please, yes, please. And so in a second, I was suddenly going to be a dame. I can't believe it still, actually.
Well, listen, it's sort of a related idea because you state in your book that you are very proud to have a monarchy. But here in Canada, the desire to drop the monarchy, it's at its highest level ever recorded. Yeah. We're not alone. I know a lot of Commonwealth countries are sort of grappling with this idea to drop the Queen as the head of state. What are your thoughts on this quickly?
Well, I think just very quickly, this book is about the Queen. So it's not a kind of book about monarchy. It's about this particular singular woman who was born not to be Queen. She was just going to be a princess. And then because her uncle abdicated, Edward VIII, suddenly she was in line to take on this phenomenal role. And I just wanted to praise her. I wanted this book to be like a bouquet of flowers saying, look, Your Majesty, all these people have had such extraordinary encounters with you, from great grand world leaders like Ban Ki-moon and Winston Churchill and even Khrushchev, right down to a little girl waving a flag in Canada or somebody watching on the side of the road in New Zealand or something. So all these extraordinary anecdotes. So it's really a book about the Queen. And I completely understand that the whole world is changing so fast that the idea of monarchs and monarchies may well just seem so out of date in countries which aren't Britain, to be fair. I mean, this is where the royal family lives. And so it's quite usual for us to have all these huge, parades of soldiers and carriages and things like this. It must seem very, very far away to Caribbean countries, to countries colossal, enormous, immense and important countries like Canada and Australia. Of course, they must be thinking about it. But this book was really my tribute to the Queen, because I think she's a wonderful woman.
And we understand that you sent her a copy. Did she respond? And if so, what did she say?
Well, you never really send anything kind of directly to the Queen. So her man, her kind of second in command, you know, the person who does all this thing, I think he's called Sir Edward Young. Anyway, I said, would it be possible to dedicate the book to Her Majesty? And back came the polite mate saying, I hope you won't be disappointed, but the Queen decided long ago never to have any books dedicated to her. And I wrote back and said, could I perhaps send her a copy of it? And they said, please do that kind thing, and we will make sure it is placed in front of Her Majesty. They didn't say Her Majesty will read it. And And actually, I have a feeling that neither she nor the late Prince Philip ever read any books about themselves at all. But just the idea that it might have been brought in on a silver salver, and she might have just looked.
That is a nice thought indeed. And Joanna, we can't have you here without talking about the British cult show Absolutely Fabulous and your absolutely iconic character, Patsy Stone. I mean, the fashion in that show was absolutely extraordinary. What do you miss most about the show?
Laughing. We just laughed all the time. Although we did it live in front of a television audience, in front of an audience of the BBC, so we really tried our hardest. We tried never to get it wrong. It was half an hour live television in front of an audience. During rehearsals, honestly, we used to just cry with laughter. We used to lie down on the floor and laugh and laugh and laugh, because the two characters that Jennifer and I played were so disgusting and so repellent, and everything they did was so out of order and cruel and vacant and greedy and self-serving, that they were just bliss to play. Very, very funny people. And we just adored doing it. And I think I miss that comradeship. And of course, all the others, Jane and Julia and June Whitfield, who's now died. But the five J's, we used to call ourselves, who were the core company, Mother and Safi and Bubble, and then Adina and Patsy. Mm. We were just as happy as anything. Laughed and laughed and laughed. And I think that back-breaking laughter. Do you know, I don't think we could do the show today because the world has become much more politically correct. Mm-hmm. And I think they'd go through and go, well, no drug taking and no smoking and not that excessive drinking and not that bad language. And you'd go, there's nothing left, you know.
Well, Dave, Joanna Lumley, we could speak with you all day. What an absolute delight to have you on the show today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. And all my love to Canada.
Thank you. We want to remind everybody your book is entitled A Queen for All Seasons, a celebration of Queen Elizabeth II on her Platinum Jubilee. It is out now.
You've been listening to The Social Podcast on the iHeartRadio Canada Network. The conversation continues on The Social. That's weekdays at 1 p.m. on CTV. Join us.
Don't miss a fiery debate. Subscribe to The Social Podcast on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your favorite shows. Until next time, socialites.